not control. If you just got rid of this security, these people would be a lot less willing to ruthlessly prey on society. Prudently, Matt here explains that at the pinnacle of our problem are those that benefit most from the current hegemony, the executors of these new empires that surpass nation. The logo is their flag, the dollar is their creed, we are all their unwitting subjects. People can argue about the right level of guard labour, said Matt. You conceivably could still have public police, but their job should be to help protect everyone, not just a special class. If you got rid of all these private systems or some of these systems of surveillance and coercive guarding of property, you'd have a lot less inequality, and powerful and wealthy people would spend a lot more time trying to make sure that society was harmonious instead of just hiring their way out of the damage they can create. How clever of Matt to offer a policy that will require further change, that has built into it a kind of doomsday device that ensures further fairness. We get caught up in abstruse nomenclature, but we're talking about pretty simple stuff here. Fairness. Sharing. My mate Nick said, if you're in a school playground with 20 kids in it and a couple of them took all the toys, you wouldn't just say, oh well, that's life. You'd explain to them that sharing is a basic human value and redistribute the toys. Let's overlook the fact that in this allegory we're hanging around in a playground with unsupervised children. We might be teachers or lollipop men. Don't just assume we're pedos. That's not the point. The point is, with children, you know that kids who don't share are in a way suffering as much as the kids who are deprived of Barbie or Xboxes or whatever the hell it is they have now. The minority that are hoarding resources are misguided in their belief that it can make them happy, and we have to be the adults and help them. By dismantling the machinery of capitalism, winning over the military with our flower power claptrap, and redistributing all their wealth. It's much easier in the allegory, where all you have to do is snatch a Rubik's Cube off a toddler and give it to some whimpering coward in a sandpit, even with the pedo allegations. Given that Matt's first suggestion has brought about a terrifying free-for-all and likely reignited the war between India and Pakistan, I was curious to see what else he had up the sleeve of his Harvard blazer. Yeah, he did go to Harvard, the bloody hypocrite. His next idea to create a different world was equally cunning and revolutionary. Get rid of all titles. Mr. President, Ambassador, Admiral, Senator, The Honourable, Your Honour, Captain, Doctor. These are all titles that capitalism relies on to justify treating some people better than other people. Matt is an American, so when it comes to deferring to the entitled, let's face it, he's an amateur compared to the British. Look at me, simpering to Professor Slingerland whenever he's mentioned. I can't wait to prostrate myself before his sceptre of diplomas. I'm a right little lick-spittle sneak down the doctors and all. Yes, doctor. No, doctor, please don't let me die, doctor. Charge what you must, doctor. Stick your finger where you fancy, doctor. Plus, we've got a royal family. What's he going to say about that? One of the most remarkable things you learn when you work in a position of political influence is just how much titles separate the wealthy and the politicians from citizens. Ordinary people will use a title before addressing someone, and that immediately makes that ordinary person a supplicant and the titled one a person of influence. Or if both have titles, then there's upper class solidarity. Rank, hierarchy, these are designed to create a structure whereby power is shaped in the very act of greeting someone. I'm getting angry again. Matt's right. Titles are part of the invisible architecture of our social structure. I'm never using one again. If I ever see Professor Slingerland in the street, I shall alert him by hollering, "Oi, fuckface!" then throw a hazelnut at him. What does Matt propose? One thing you can do to negate this power is to be firm but respectful and address anyone and everyone by their last name. Mr., Ms., or Mrs. is all the title you should ever need. This allows you to treat everyone as your equal, and it shows everyone that they should treat you as their equal. Right, fair enough. I went in a bit hard there on old Teddy Slingerland, or just Mr. Slingerland, according to Matt's polite revolution. His suggestion of equal titles for all of us is provocative. Particularly those of us who live in monarchies. I mean, in England, we have a queen, for fuck's sake. A queen! We have to call her things like Your Majesty. Your Majesty! majesty, like she's all majestic, like an eagle or a mountain. She's just a person, a little old lady in a shiny hat that we paid for. Or your highness, what the fuck is that? What, she's high up above us at the top of a class pyramid on a shelf of money with her own face on it? We should be calling her Mrs. Windsor. In fact, that's not even her real name. They changed it in the war to distract us from the inconvenient fact that they were as German as the enemy that teenage boys were being encouraged, conscripted actually, to die fighting. Her actual name is Mrs. Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Mrs. Saxe-Coburg-Gotha? No wonder they fucking changed it. It's the most German thing I've ever heard. She might as well have been called Mrs. Bratwurst-Kraut-Nazi. Titles have got to go. I'm not calling her Your Highness or Your Majesty just so we can pretend there isn't and hasn't always been an international cabal of rich landowners flitting merrily across the globe, getting us all to kill each other a couple of times a decade. From now on, she's Frau Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Come on, Frau Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. It's time for you to have breakfast with her, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. And you can make it yourselves. And by the way, we're nicking this fucking great castle you've been dossing in and giving it to 100 poor families. Actually, you can stay if you want. They'll need a cleaner. You'll have to watch your lip, though, her Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Some of them ain't white. We British have much to gain from Matt's titleless utopia. He continues. It's a small thing, seemingly inconsequential, but it's not. No, not to the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas, they're well fucked. If this became common, you'd shortly see sputtering rage from the powerful and increased agitation from the erstwhile meek. People need to mark their dominance. That is the essence of highly unequal capitalism. If they can't do so, if they aren't allowed to be dominant, to be shown as being dominant, then the system cannot long be sustained. Matt's ideas are like the schemes of a cackling supervillain from a Bond movie. At first they seem innocuous, but then they elegantly unravel the fabric of society. He suggests we start now. This is something that anyone and everyone can act on. A tiny act of rebellion that takes no money, influence or social status. You just need courage. And every human has that. Chapter 11. A Pair of Dames and a Double Slit. It was likely one of my early marches in which I noticed the police are actually normal blokes in unusual outfits. Trafalgar Square, on a bright spring day, emerging from the underground, bleary-eyed and tousled like the kids in Peter Pan, to the fairground mayhem of a protest on the brink. Horses galloping and paving slabs ripped up. Everything all different but the same, like my face on acid or the last day of school when you can bring games and not wear uniform. Or an ancient Roman carnival where the servants and the masters change roles. Carnivals and fairs are a break in the norm to let off some steam. Carne means meat and refers, in this context, to celebrations that centre on a feast. The allotted reapportioning of meat, so that the people that got the prime cuts get the sausages and them that feast on bangers get steak. Overseen by Hermes or Mercury or whatever tricksty deity was germane to the culture. That's probably why we enjoy I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here or when a politician gets egged or scandalised. These social vows prevent uprising and a permanent reordering of social hierarchies. In mass demonstrations, I feel that trickster spirit surge. The people are sick of sausages and are coming for your steak. Not me, I'm vegetarian. I prefer the playful spirit of Hermes in protest, regardless of how serious the objectives, as piety and solemnity are tyrants too, oppressing ludic joy. When up against the wall of police shields, when you've been well kettled, that means herded, you're face to face with your oppressor, or rather the guardians of order. The oppressors are miles away at Whitehall or Wall Street or at a Bilderberg meeting. The men and women who hold the shields are people like us, same fears, desires, accents. They just have a costume and a few months training at Hendon Police College under their belt. Human beings who want the best for their families. David Cameron said in a rare foray into compassion, hug a hoodie. He was right, we should. We should also cuddle a copper. Was that a bit, yeah man, a bit reductive? It will be. The solution will not be rarefied, the revolution will be televised and it will be easy and based on simple things like interconnectivity and union or love. I'm still reeling from citing David Cameron, but actually he's a human too, isn't he? Strip away all the Bullingdon balderdash and the blary gesticulations and he's a bloke with kids and a wife and a god, sporadically, and a day that he will die and people that will cry. It's not that we want an old-style revolution of guillotines and gulags and big fancy show trials. It's actually a powerful but gentle process where we align to a new frequency, a social recalibration. We don't want to replace Cameron with another leader. The position of leader elevates a particular set of behaviours. My mate Nick said the first act after a successful revolution should be the execution of its leaders. Brutal but smart. What he means is the type of people that lead revolutions have tendencies that could become corrosive in a position of power. We have to overthrow systems, inner and outer. We have to overthrow the David Cameron in our head. We can also overthrow the literal one. That will be more fun. Sometimes when I'm casually condemning them, the politicians, the Halliburtons, the media, the Bilderberg regulars, the presumed Illuminati, I pause to consider my own conduct. Am I just a less efficient tyrant confined to the sphere of my own little life? The fact is, I am sometimes a bit. I worry that my flaws, broadcast on a global stage, would bring about a tyranny not dissimilar to the one we're trying to replace. My own defects of character, if not addressed by a spiritual program, would make me as toxic as Rupert Murdoch or Hitler. Legal asterisk. I'm not saying that Rupert Murdoch is as bad as Hitler. Hitler's warmongering and genocide remain unchallenged as the greatest crimes of modern times. However, a man in the position of power that Murdoch is in, choosing to neglect the possibility to make the world a fairer, more loving place, and instead electing to spread fear, suspicion and prejudice while obscuring facts about highly controversial but profitable practices like fracking, could bring down all humanity. Legally, though, I'm obliged to say that Hitler and Murdoch are two distinct entities and that Hitler was a worse bloke. The Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, and please don't be intimidated by the inclusion of such an esoteric reference, in 15 seconds you'll know as much about his work as I do, the dividing line between good and evil cuts through every human heart. We all have dualistic and dueling intentions. This is why systems are more important than individuals, and the ideals we promote more important still. It's also why David Graeber, remember him, over there on the other side of that New Orleans anecdote that rolled by like the Mississippi, believes that we must be wary of concentrated power, even if the intention is to bring about a fair and self-governing society. I think one thing we've learned is that creating more centralised power to be able to start a process which is supposed to eventually lead to less centralised power always backfires, he said. I feel the manner in which we construct our social organisations is integral. Rather than just eradicating the systems, we could also consider adjusting them to authentically fulfil their stated roles. A Member of Parliament or a Congressman is supposed to represent us. That means they convey our collective will. That is not what is currently happening. The police force in America pledged to protect and serve. That would actually be dandy if it were happening. Bill Hicks used to joke that he'd like to hijack a typically unpunctual plane and force it to go to its scheduled destination on time. David Graeber said the radical alternative that we should be aiming towards is democracy, because whatever it is that we are toiling under now, it is not democracy. Democracy means if enough people want a fairer society with more sharing, well-supported institutions and less exploitation by organisations that do not contribute, then their elected representatives will ensure that it is enacted. I suppose that corruption by definition is a deviation, a perversion from the intended path. We know that's not what's happening, don't we? We know, for example, that the dismantling and privatisation of the National Health Service is not for the benefit of us, the people who use it. It benefits the government that proposed it and the companies that are purchasing it. Nobody voted for that because nobody would be stupid enough to give us the option. This troubles me not intellectually, but spiritually. Spirituality ought not be ethereal or insubstantial, but pragmatic and active. The reason I feel optimistic in such a superficially gloomy and apocalyptic climate is I know that there are wonderful possibilities for our species that we are only just beginning to reconsider. When the physicist speaks of the expanding universe with atheistic wonder, he is feeling the same transcendent pull that Rumi describes. Do you know what you are? You are a manuscript of a divine letter. You are a mirror reflecting a noble face. This universe is not outside of you. Look inside yourself. Everything that you want, you are already that. Rumi was a Sufi mystic, though I imagine if you don't know who Rumi was, the addition of the definition Sufi mystic isn't tremendously helpful. Who is Alan Devonshire? He had a great left peg, but dodgy knees. Oh, thank you for clarifying. The manifest world is telling us what to do with increasingly obvious signals. We need only look at our codes. Symptoms are signals. We are becoming, through technology, increasingly adept at reading and responding to signals. Alas, due to the perverse prevailing ideology, we are ignoring the most important messages. The people that currently have the power are tuned in on the wrong side of Solzhenitsyn's line, temporarily forgetting that they are divinely connected, hence ecological meltdown. The obvious signals that we need to switch to different energy systems are being ignored because they're watching another channel where the moot, outdated signal of individualistic self-advancement is being bombastically broadcast. Now is the time to change channels. Where now can we feel this connection in our pre-packed and prescripted lives? Where are we supposed to have time amidst the deadening thud of our futile duties? You'll find God among the poor, they say. Is that true anymore? Is the connection between poverty and divinity simply a panacea for the world's destitute, an assurance that they'll be rewarded in the hereafter? Or does a material deficit provide space for God? My love of God elevates the intention of this book beyond the dry and admirable establishment of collectivized communities. I'm enraptured by the magnetic pull of evolution. What is this energy that heals the body and escalates one cell to two, that repairs and creates and calculates in harmony with environment outside of time? Where is evolution trying to go? Evolutionary psychologists would likely say the imposition of an anthropocentric concept like trying or intending is naive, but I'm not going to ask one. They get enough airtime, the killjoys. I remain uncharmed by the incessant rationalization that requires the spirit's capitulation. The infusion of the scientific with the philosophical is materialism. The manifesto for our salvation is not in this sparse itinerary. This all-encompassing realm, this consciousness beyond mind, cannot be captured with language any more than you can appreciate Caravaggio by licking the canvas, or Mozart by sniffing the notes on a stave. The Transcendental Meditation Foundation, which taught me to meditate, conducted an experiment in Washington to evaluate the effects of concentrated meditation on that city's crime figures. They got a group of people ranging between a few hundred to 1,000 to meditate in a hotel to see if this would impact the behaviour of the wider community. From a cynical perspective, it was a bold experiment to embark upon. Why would a bunch of, I'm going to assume, hippies sitting still in a room thinking a word changed the way a criminal outside in Washington would behave? In fact, who funded this madness? It makes no material sense. We are living in a material world and I'm a material girl, sang Madonna. And she's right. It is. And she is. Quantum physicist John Hagelin was one of the scientists behind this experiment. I've chatted to him about meditation and asked for neurological data that advances meditation beyond an esoteric practice for bearded wizards in the Himalayas. Transcendental meditation, though, was actually brought to the West by a bearded wizard from the Himalayas. Known as the Maharishi, you might recognise him from the 60s, when he was at the epicentre of a countercultural explosion, perched cross-legged on a flower-strewn stage with the Beatles. The technique of TM that the Maharishi taught them is the type of meditation that I use. Hagelin describes it as a tool to get beyond thought to the source of thought. When scanned in a meditative state, the brain behaves in a tangibly distinct electrophysical way, a fourth state of consciousness, awake, asleep, dreaming, and the meditative state. There is some distance to traverse, according to conventional thinking, between meditation producing unusual brainwaves and crime falling in a major metropolis as a result of a group of people practicing it. Over the course of the two-month experiment, crime fell by 23%. What's more, the figure increased in tandem with the number of people practicing. John Hagelin said, through meditation we can access the unity beyond diversity, that beyond the atomic, subatomic, nuclear, subnuclear, there is a unified field. The results of this experiment suggest that if a significant proportion of a population regularly meditate, it will affect consciousness beyond the people involved. Burglaries, street crime and violence all fell as a result of the state of consciousness achieved by a group of people inwardly thinking a word until a state beyond thought was reached. That's weird. It is irrefutable proof that beyond the world that we can currently measure with tools as yet inept for such an advanced task, there is a connection between the apparently separate consciousnesses of individuals. Consciousness exists beyond your head, between our heads, and it can manifest harmony. That is perilously close to affirmation of a higher power. My experiences of meditation began before bearded pyjama time, which a friend of mine is encouraging me to describe as a mental breakdown. I don't think it was, as I would say that despair is a necessary ingredient of a breakdown. What did happen at the time of my divorce was that a lot of my beliefs and their outward manifestations fell away. My marriage ended as a result of the kind of incompatibility recognisable to anyone who's been through a breakup. Where mine may have differed is that my wedding and accompanying move to Los Angeles represented to me the crescendo of a particular type of thinking. I, like a lot of people who come from somewhere glum, was trying to be something spectacular, always though with the subtly unabating knowledge, like an unaddressed itch, that change comes from within. The myth of the genie and his wishes, or the stories of Midas or Faust, are all, I suppose, telling the same story, that you cannot outwardly acquire solutions. Anyone as indoctrinated by capitalism as me will miss the point in these tales. The Midas touch is still thought of as a positive thing, as opposed to the gift to turn your wife into an inanimate lump of metal. The three genie wishes always leads to the hapless recipient slumped head on hands lamenting, "I wish I'd appreciated things the way they were." Sorry, no more wishes. Usually in these stories, people wish for fame and fortune and sex and power. The things kids today want, maybe not the sex, fed on Closer or Us Weekly or whatever. It's what I wanted. These primary coloured, neon-lit goals are what a lot of people want and serve as a kind of psychological signpost that bluntly indicates, away from here. The present isn't good enough. The people in these magazines seem happy, or at least heightened. Their faces are papped mandala for the contemplation of the secular flock. Transcendental meditation practitioners have established a community in Fairfield, Iowa, where they can live in accordance with the Vedic principles behind TM. It is most recognisable for its two iconic meditation domes, which loom like tranquil boobs plopped onto the pastoral view. I just turned myself on then. That can't have been their intention. The members of this community are attempting to inhabit a kind of utopia, to live now in accordance with spiritual ideas, not to regard the ideal society as a tantalising pipe dream forever out of reach, but as a daily reality. I shall tell you now, and for no extra charge, that living in the present seems to be the key component across every scripture, self-help book and religious group I've encountered. To harmonise with life in each moment, not to make happiness contingent on any prospective condition, not to be tormented by the past, but to live in the reality of now, all else being a mental construct. Osho, Eckhart Tolle, Jesus, Buddha, Oprah, anyone who's ever grown a beard or shaved their head or dropped out and looked back at the material world with a sage shake of the head, a knowing wag of the finger and a beatific smile are all saying, snap out of it, liberate yourself from the tyranny of egoic introspection. This is the seam of the self that consumerism can continually mine, the unrelenting inner voice that wants and fears, that attaches and rejects. The people in robes and beards want us to learn to live beyond it, to calmly watch the chattering ego like clouds moving across a perfect sky, to identify with the stillness that is aware of the voice, that hears the voice, not the voice itself. Well, that's easy for them to say, all relaxed in their flowing robes like giant hairy babies. It's extremely difficult, especially when that voice has such omnipresent external allies to rely on, whilst the very idea of a spiritual life has been marginalised and maligned. Perhaps this state needn't be the product of strenuous esotericism. It's possible that calm presence of mind is our natural state, and our jittery materialism the result of constant indoctrination. Much as I love spirituality to be served up properly, branded in a turban, dressed in curtains, the accoutrements are surely an aesthetic, not a prerequisite. Once on holiday on the Pacific coast of Mexico, I met a man who possessed a stubborn spirituality that was more earth than air, more leather than muslin. I was on the kind of luxurious holiday that will be coldly ground out like a mink cigar when sanity is restored, to stay in a resort called Quixymala, which I will never be confident writing or pronouncing due to that X in the middle of it. I flew into Puerto Vallarta Airport from Los Angeles, then had to get a prop plane from there to the resort. Me and my mate Nicola travelled there together, she in the role of an adult nanny to facilitate the extended infancy that fame affords. Fame is like a sequin-covered suit of armour that provides a holographic cover for actual me. Most people, whether their opinion is positive or negative, are content to deal with the avatar, leaving me as tender as crab meat within. Really, it's an amplification of what happens if you're not famous. I don't imagine that we are often interacting on the pure frequency of essential nature. We usually have a pre-existing set of conditions and coordinates that we project onto people we meet or circumstances we encounter. This is not just a psychological notion. Robert Lanza, in his concept-smashing book Biocentrism, explains that our perception of all physical external phenomena is in fact an internal reconstruction, elaborating on the results of experiments in quantum physics that particles behave differently when under observation, itself a universe-shattering piece of information, so that, and forgive my inelegant comprehension of the quantum world, electrons fired out of a tiny little cannon, when unobserved, make a pattern that reveals they have behaved as a wave, and when observed, the kinky little bastards behave as particles. That's a bit fucking mad, if you ask me. That's like finding out that when you go out, your dog stands up on its hind legs, lights a fag, and starts making phone calls, or turns into a cloud. Lanza describes how our conception of a candle as a yellow flame burning on a wick is a kind of mentally constructed illusion. He says an unobserved candle would have no intrinsic brightness or yellowness. These qualities require an interaction with consciousness, the bastard. A flame, he explains, is a hot gas. Like any light source, it emits photons, which are tiny packets of electromagnetic energy, which means electrical and magnetic impulses. Lanza points out that we know from our simple, sexy, everyday lives that electricity and magnetic energy have no visual properties. There is nothing inherently visual about a flame until the electromagnetic impulses, if measuring between 400 and 700 nanometers in length from crest to crest, hit the cells in our retinas at the back of the eye. This makes a complex matrix of neurons fire in our brains, and we subjectively perceive this as yellow brightness occurring in the external world. Other creatures would see grey. At most, we can conclude, says Lanza, that there is a stream of electromagnetic energy that, if denied correlation with human consciousness, is impossible to conceptualise. So when Elton John said that Marilyn Monroe lived her life like a candle in the wind, he was probably bloody right. And if he wasn't, we'll never know. We apply reality from within. The world is our perception of the world, so what other people think of you, famous or not, is an independent construct taking place in their brain, and we shouldn't worry too much about it. On my trip to Mexico, I encountered Ernesto, who clearly didn't give a toss about fame. Me and Nick were due to be met at Puerto Vallarta, we knew not by whom. As soon as I saw Ernesto there, half-heartedly holding a sign with a pseudonym on it and a fag a lot more committedly, I became curious. He wore a cloth baseball cap like a mechanic in a movie, a red polo shirt and shorts. Everything he wore looked like it had at some point been used to polish an engine. He looked weathered. I suppose that means like he'd been alive a while and spent a lot of time outside. As I approached, I noticed that I couldn't easily imagine this man observing the usual custom in this circumstance and carrying my luggage. He didn't. I noticed I was disgruntled, but left that unexpressed. Brown he was, Ernesto, nicotine-stained fingers, good like wood compared to plastic, I observed as he greeted us with a fraction of a smile, a few words in Spanish, and smoked his way from the main terminal to the smaller adjacent terminal where the prop plane awaited. It was a red and yellow plane, so comically small and vivid, it might as well have been a cartoon. It in fact looked like Jimbo, an anthropomorphic aeroplane from children's BBC in the 80s. It was such a diminutive aviation device that boarding it was more akin to putting on a jacket than getting on a plane. It became clear, but was never explained, that Ernesto was the pilot when he got in the driving seat and started pressing buttons. Nicola is a nervous flyer, which is annoying because we all die in plane crashes, not just nervous people, but we, the fearless, are expected to console and coo and tell him it's okay and list statistics about air travel's relative safety. You're more likely to die in a road accident, etc. Well, I'm sick of it. They're getting short shrift from me now, these blubbering sky Nancies. Phobias are like fetishes, if you ask me. Nurtured little perversions that the sufferers secretly enjoy. The last time a nervous flyer tried it on with me, I barked at her like she was talking in an exam and threatened to sit on her. Nicola sat in the back, which was like she was perched in a knapsack on my back, and nervously eyed Ernesto as he, with the slapdash dexterity of a bare-knuckle croupier, prodded and jabbed dials and switches. He indicated that we should put the seatbelts on. They were those ones that have no spring-loaded recoil, like in an old car. It was like draping a dressing gown cord over your shoulder. We took off with the sense of excitement that accompanies the thrill of a fairground ride with none of the guaranteed safety. When I meet a new person, I like to take them in, give them a damn good staring at, and check my files for references. I suppose that's the beginning of prejudice. Ernesto seemed to be softening, perhaps as a result of our excitement at taking off. He began to take on the role of guide, pointing out interesting bays and coves as we flew along the coastline. "Here we will see sharks," he said, lowering the altitude, and sure enough we could make out a dappled grey slither of wickedness shimmering in the azure. I began to quiz Ernesto to see if he matched up to my prejudices. I assumed him to be a man who'd lived in close harmony with the land and with machines, a pragmatic man. He may never have left Mexico, I thought. He continued to beguile with cavalier nods to jungle gaps where marijuana crops grew, and, encouraged by our interest as the resort drew near, incorporated some aeronautical stunt work into his repertoire, swooping down till we were yards above the beach, swimming village kids waved like the opening credits of a travel programme. He dive-bombed a jeep on a dirt track, his former grease monkey persona replaced by the debonair grace of a World War I flying ace. I felt great joy and safety and decided that I loved this man. Between stunts, I'd looked at his eyes and they were blue like the sea, and like the sea they had sharks in them. Wild, untamable nature and certainty. Connection and power, warmth. I immediately and unthinkingly made him a father figure. When Nicola, who was leaving the next day to fly to London, was taxied back by Ernesto, I went along for the ride. This time, a seasoned co-pilot with 40 minutes' experience, I felt able to switch off a little and not be so self-consciously dazzled by the view. I took to my phone to make a few texts and whatnot. I must have stared mute and listless for longer than Ernesto deemed suitable, as he jerked the plane violently up, then down, taking my breath away and making me audibly yelp. He looked at me and smiled. "In the moment," he said. I'm not often chided as an adult. I usually just do what I want, and drifting into a wet-lipped torpor agog at the screen of my self-administered eye tag is one of the ways I voluntarily squander the gift of life. Well, Ernesto weren't having it. He'd given himself the role of elder and was belatedly initiating me into the present. "Travel in the old ruts," quotes my friend Meredith, some ancient Chinese maxim. "The way laid down by elders. Pathways through the world, pathways through the mind. It's a shame that these days we so seldom have a guide, that our atomized worldview, mimicking scientific doctrine, sees us as separate, distinct, alone, orbiting in space, touching only an infinite void." My cognitive sleuthing about old Ernesto was quite wrong. He was well-travelled and had resided in Paris and had lived all kinds of urbane adventures. He'd been flying since he was 15, though, and up there was so confident and connected it was hypnotic. It's helpful for me to have differing visions of what spirituality might be, that it can be expressed with dog ends, not dog collars, tattered caps, not turbans, infinite potential up there in the moment, in the clouds. Chapter 12, Within You, Without You. The Fairfield Transcendental Meditation community have attempted to create external conditions that support a higher cause. Of course, the fear with such a community is that it might be a bit insipid and weird or seem like a cult. I spent a few weeks there to see what it was like to be in an environment that nourished serenity, and if I could live comfortably with serenity's immediate neighbours, earnestness and humourlessness. Even if untroubled by these conceptual neighbours, the inhabitants of the meditation community in Fairfield have literal neighbours to contend with. They cohabit their town with the ordinary rural community of Fairfield, present long before a glorious set of transcendent knockers jiggled onto the horizon, generating a dissonant hum in the small town centre. Adjacent to the predictable pine-wooden paperbacks vegan restaurant, there's a bar selling coors and shots with a stag-hunting arcade game in the corner. The indigenous labourers, I noted, eyed the newcomers the way any immigrant community can be viewed, as threatening and unwelcome, tranquil invaders from another dimension. The problem with communities built around sitting still and doing nothing is that, yes, you guessed it, they're a bit fucking boring, particularly to people like me, brought up on shopping centres, porno mags and crack. When I'm in a TM-themed cafe about to bite into something made of parsley, I might think, fuck this, there's an arcade game next door where I can shoot Bambi in the bonts. This attitude of churlish indifference seems like nerdish deference contrasted with the belligerent antipathy of the indigenous farm folk who regard the hippy-dippy interlopers, the denizens of the shimmering tit temples, as one phase step away from transvestites. I shall tell you the one negative thing about the TM community I can think of, just to get it off my chest, then I can resume my primary purpose of encouraging you to incorporate spiritual practice of some kind into your life. They do a thing called yogic flying. Now, if someone says to me, Russell, would you like to partake in some yogic flying? The image I have is of myself and a few hippies levitating like Aladdin, blissed out and superior, looking down on the world in every conceivable way. If the reality of the situation is a bunch of people with their legs crossed, hopping across crash mats, a hybrid of a sports day sack race and the Paralympics, I shall feel shortchanged. I urge my brethren in the New Age realms, those of us who want to change the world, whether from a radical political perspective or a spiritual one, to be fastidious. Richard Dawkins is watching, like the librarian of all Earth's knowledge, shushing and prodding and demanding overdue diligence. If we tell Dickie Dawkins we at last have proof of the supernatural, that we are finally manifesting a glorious new dawn for humankind, that we are ready to join the angels, then invite him into a giant tit in Iowa and show him what looks like some highly motivated amputees clamouring for a top-shelf magazine, he is unlikely to be impressed. Not that impressing Dickie Dawkins is the aim of the game. He's made up his mind to be dour. I'd hate to go on holiday with him.
These pyramids are inaccurate. Fetch my spirit level. Actually, just get me a normal level. I don't believe in spirits. No, I don't want to buy a fez.
Whilst I stayed in Fairfield, Bobby Roth, a remarkable man, in essence a priest of the TM faith, taught me to meditate. Bob would eschew the priestly title, as the TM movement is understandably keen to avoid any mantles that prevent its powerful technology being unappealing to secular people because it sounds out there, or religious people if it seems to conflict with their ideology. To me, though, Bob, who has become a dear friend, is a type of priest or swami, a devoted man. I've recently begun to look for people's vicar nature. It's a technique I happened upon quite by chance, but I think it has a precedent in Eastern mysticism. In Buddhism, they talk of each of us having a Buddha nature, a divine self, the aspect of our total persona that is beyond our materialism and individualism. Well, that's all well and good. What I'm into is people's vicar nature. What a person would be like if they were a vicar. You can do it on anyone. It doesn't have to be a vicar either if that isn't your bag. It could be a rabbi or an imam or whatever. Simply think of someone you know, like, I don't know, Hulk Hogan, and imagine them as a devotional being. When I do, it helps me to see where their material persona intersects with a well-meaning spiritual aspect. Reverend Hogan would be, I suspect, a real fire and brimstone guy, spasming and retching in the pulpit, but easily moved to tears perhaps by the plight of a childless couple in his parish. Anyway, let's not get carried away. It's just a tool to help me see where a person's essential self might dwell. Oddly, it's really easy to do with atheists. I can imagine Richard Dawkins as a vicar in an instant, Calvinist and insistent, dogmatic and determined, having a stern hearthside chat with a 17-year-old boy on the cusp of coming out. My point is that in spite of the lack of any theological title, Bobby Roth is like a priest. We learned TM, Nick and I, over 4 days in one-hour sessions that were mostly technical with minimal ritualism and mysticism. The only standout bit of hocus-pocus was in the final session when a rose and some rice were placed on an altar. The majority of the time was spent learning the technique. The technique is this. You shut your eyes and inwardly, silently, think a mantra. A mantra is just a word or a series of words, in this case, a word. You think the word the way you would think any thought, in a relaxed, unforced way. Not like an angry inner shout, that defeats the object. You calmly, silently repeat mantra. Then again, mantra. You continually think mantra. If you notice another thought come, and it will, you don't get wound up like you're a Texan border guard and your own thoughts are Mexican fence hoppers. You just calmly return to thinking mantra. Mantra is just an example, by the way. Your word is secret. It is given to you by your teacher and you mustn't tell anyone else. That was one of the hardest aspects of the process, actually. I nearly went mad not telling my mantra to anyone else. I was like the protagonist in an Edgar Allan Poe story, demented by my secret knowledge, a metal pellet of metronomic guilt pinging off the bars in my mind. Even writing about it now makes me want to type it in a gaudy font made of lime green letters, but I won't because I'm so fucking spiritual. Apparently, this desire to grasp on your own mantra is common. I told a kid in the community school about it. She said she'd had it too when she first learned, and I felt relieved by the kinship. Then she went, yeah, but I was only 7. After a while, sitting in silence, the repetition of the mantra becomes natural or hypnotic. Sometimes, even now, it takes ages, like my brain is an over-entitled and caffeinated lodger banging down cups and whistling TV jingles. It's fucking annoying. Honestly, sometimes I'm sitting, I'm sure looking double Christ-like, but inward I'm thinking with the forensic specificity of a master forger, an absolute facsimile of the Kylie Minogue song I Should Be So Lucky. How does my brain do that? It is the exact song, perfectly recreated, every synthetic beat and squeak rendered as authentically as if Kylie was inside my skull. Amazing as it is that the brain can conjure up these neurological illusions, which on some subtle level are a physical reality, like they must be made of an electrical impulse which has a charge or a weight. It's a fucking drag when I can't voluntarily stop it. There is no limit to what can be imagined either. We can now, in this moment, command the mind to play the Kylie track, then instead of her singing it, have the words emerge from the mouth of an elephant in dark glasses. Your mind is doing it now, it exists. Then you can put your school's hardest kid in there. Mine was Jamie Dawkins, no relation. Put him on the elephant's back, dressed as Bin Laden, singing the harmonies. We have now created that with conscious energy. It has a charge and a weight. It is real and distinct from nothingness. The absence of that thought object has a different weight and charge. Given that we live in infinite space, I don't, I live in Shoreditch, the difference between that thought object as imagined and as reality in our shared consensual material realm is negligible. I mean, if space is limitless, then the difference in size between an electron, an atom, a golf ball, a football, the moon, the earth, Jupiter is all irrelevant because the context has no limit. If you put a golf ball and a football on a table in front of you, the difference in size seems significant. If you go to the other side of the room, less so. If you go down the street, the difference is even less significant. If you looked from the moon, it would be hard to notice. That might seem like a big jump, but it isn't because we are talking about a realm beyond contextualization. This is what exists in consciousness, a potentially limitless realm in which we can engineer then project new realities. The astronaut Edgar D. Mitchell said of his experience of viewing Earth from the moon, "You develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on the moon, international politics looks so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag him a quarter of a million miles and say, 'Look at that, you son of a bitch!'" I love this quote for many reasons. One, because it illustrates that all the well-meaning talk of oneness, such as you have found in this book, is built upon an empirical reality. We're all one, the human family. When you pull back to outer space or dive within to inner space, that becomes clear. I like that travelling to the moon was such an emotional and spiritual experience for Edgar, as I've always thought that astronauts would be tough military types that wouldn't be given to such profound pronouncements. Mostly, though, I love his violent conclusion that he'd like to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and take him to the moon. Firstly, because to grab anyone by the scruff of the neck is an animal and implausible thing to do. I just felt the back of my neck and there's barely any scruff to grab. Unless this politician had a particularly fat neck, Edgar would have to be content with an inch of skin between his thumb and forefinger like he was holding a teacup. He might as well have his pinky finger extended. Then he'd have to kidnap the bloke, presumably from Washington, drag him all the way to Cape Canaveral, Florida, into the NASA HQ, presumably give him some basic space training, put him in a suit, a rocket, strap him in, spend a few days getting to the moon, then finally march him out and admonish him for his lack of perspective. I don't think he could sustain his indignation for that long. I reckon he'd start to feel a connection to the terrified politician at some point during that journey, possibly in the training section where they have to acclimatise to zero gravity in a swimming pool. Also, surely once Edgar got back to the moon and he looked back to Earth, his love of all the members of the human family would kick back in and he might feel too guilty to lay into the sobbing and vertiginous undisclosed politician. Among the small number of people who have seen our planet from space, this sense of enlightenment is seemingly common. There are loads of comparable quotes that illustrate this strong sense of connection and fraternity. I chose Edgar D. Mitchell's one because he's the only astronaut who saw his epiphany as an impetus to snatch a senator and beat him up on the moon like an intergalactic Vito Corleone. In meditation through the repetition of your mantra, or in other techniques with the focus of your attention on your breath, a candle or a riddle, eventually thought relents. What is consciousness when thought abates? What I have experienced when I'm able to get through the inner tics and mental tricks that the ego uses to prevent transcendence is a warm relief. I had it today. At first, when I closed my eyes, I was uncomfortable and had to adjust myself. My back or legs or nuts can feel taut or trapped and I can't relax. I notice sometimes that I'm holding tension in my jaw or my shoulders. I consciously let it go. How can you be at peace if you're subtly exerting pressure, holding energy somewhere in your body? The first condition is quiet. The second is comfort. Then I can start. Today, the Monty Python Lumberjack song was in residence in my head. I'd just watched it online, and when I shut my eyes, it vividly replayed. I didn't try to kick the jaunty ditty and grinning Michael Palin off the carousel of thoughts. I instead focused on letting go of the tension in my jaw and pulling a trapped bit of ball bag out from between my legs. It was my own ball bag. This management of anatomical minutiae completed, I began thinking the mantra. The mantra vied with Palin and my jaw for mental supremacy. I stay relaxed and detached. I don't get aggressive about asserting the mantra. The temptation is to feel aggrieved that your own mind won't do your bidding, like Dr. Strangelove's hand saluting a disintegrated Reich of previous contemplation. The point is, though, the object of focus is not relevant. If I become attached to the idea of a perfect inward incantation, that is an egoic act. The aesthetics of thought activity are unimportant. In my experience, the mystical qualities of the mantra, by which I mean that which is not known, are secondary to the hypnotic effect of repetition. To me, it seems that eventually the busy, chattering monkey mind eventually accepts that all that is happening is the repetition of a word and just sort of fucks off to sleep. The Maharishi, and perhaps his version warrants more credence, given it was he that brought this technique to the West, described it thusly. If the mantra is the word rose, every time the word rose is repeated, the conscious mind, in anticipation of the coming repetition, moves closer to the unconscious source of thought which generates all mental phenomena. With each repetition, deeper goes the awareness that hears it in preemptive increments until eventually that awareness is submerged within the source and thus unified. The Maharishi's description is probably more scientific and prettier. Go with whatever you want. The great American comedian Jerry Seinfeld, who has practiced TM for over 30 years, puts it into typically succinct terms. It's like plugging your phone into a charger twice a day for 20 minutes. These two 20-minute interludes, one in the morning, one in the evening, also serve to remind me that there is more to life than what I'm doing and thinking, what I fear and desire, what I think of other people and what they think of me. During those times, I experience something beyond those concerns, and it's a great relief. My friend Meredith, who is archetypically a wise woman, who if we were in a fairy tale we'd meet in a wood, said to me, "Enlightenment is already present. How could it be otherwise?" Meaning that the state of enlightenment, union, Christ consciousness or whatever, must be present already in the mind, or at least the capacity for it. It's not manufactured or engineered. It is by relinquishing other stimuli or factors that this state can emerge. "The kingdom of heaven is within," said Jesus, perhaps in reference to the euphoric relief from earthly burden achieved through alignment with a pre-existing but unutilized frequency of consciousness that carries you to the bliss that exists beyond self. I experience that bliss when I meditate. it feels simultaneously relaxing and empowering. Actually, though, the awareness that it has been pleasant comes subsequently, because during a successful meditative experience, there really isn't a self to apply the labels of relaxing or empowering. I wish I had it every time, but even after 5 years practicing, sometimes my scuttling mind will not yield. The jittery busybody of my inner museum cataloguing and caterwauling, applying adjectives and conditions to external phenomena that would be best left alone. An unexpected benefit of this process is an increased compassion for others, a dawning recognition of the connection between us all. Since meditating, I feel that the intuitive connection to others that I've always felt has somehow been enhanced. I'm lucky in that I have a mother who is pathologically loving and gentle, who unfussily loves animals and children and tries to see the good in everyone, thank God, because in my case it was pretty well hidden. This perhaps inherited positive trait, though, was redundant and unexpressed for much of my life, as I was entangled in the sparkles and the spangles, mangled in the crackling drudge, addicted to attention and drugs. Since I've been clean and have increasingly made spiritual pursuits my priority, these neglected traits have become more and more definite. Don't get me wrong, erring is for me a daily occurrence. Each evening when I reflect on the day's events, like a match of the day highlight show, which is just about the stuff I've done, there's usually one or two clips where I wince at my selfishness or missed opportunities to move closer to the source. For example, part of the program I follow is to each day try to do something for someone else. If that seems gallingly obvious to you, you are likely not an addict. I can quite easily, if not guided by higher intention, spend the whole day just pursuing things for myself. Being nice to your cat or husband doesn't count. Those immediate tribal alliances could be regarded as self-serving, in that it's like pruning the garden of your life. You live in these relationships as surely as you live in your house. Maintenance is a necessity. I mean general kindness to others in the spirit of service. This can include, for someone in my position, aiding, advising and supporting other recovering drug addicts and alcoholics, taking time to help them with their frankly incessant problems and quandaries, knowing that some other poor recovering drunk will have to listen to mine. It can also mean helping strangers and people that circumstances put in your way but of no obvious benefit to you, what used to be called civility. Carrying bags, opening doors, giving up seats, putting others before yourself. I've begun to understand that in doing these things, I ameliorate the invisible boundaries that imprison me in my head. If I prioritise the needs of others, even in small ways above my own needs, the illusion of my material individual self being supreme subtly begins to break down. There is a great relief in this, as we are designed to live in communities and tribes, but these systems have in our culture for various reasons broken down, and we feel lonely as a result because we are detached from nature. I don't mean nature as in a bunch of trees and rivers, although they're nice too. I mean nature as in our own nature. We are nature. We are a part of the whole, connected to the whole, like old Edgar saw from the moon. We are all one on a speck of dust in a shaft of light. When I live in the illusion of a separate self, the part of me that knows I am at one with all phenomena feels starved and bereft. These dopey little acts of kindness move me back towards the truth. It actually gives me a little rush if I do a kind thing, like just phone someone up, someone who I want nothing from, and check if they're okay. After I've done it, I get this little tingle and I think that it's a small synaptic reward for reconnecting with truth. I once saw a depiction of the old brain in action. I saw the synapses, the nerves or tunnels or roads through which energy or information travels. It wasn't a photo. This stuff is too microscopic to be observed in that way. It was probably some sort of scan or graphic. Energy travels from synapse to synapse across a tiny space. A thought or an impulse crosses space to get to a related synapse. Consciousness, thoughts, are travelling through space in your head. We are travelling through space on this beautiful biosphere Earth. If consciousness can traverse inner space, then perhaps it can traverse outer space. Perhaps we are as connected by consciousness as we are by the air that we will breathe. The air we inhale through the holes in our faces, which tumbles into our lungs and blood, which travels through our hearts, which forms the words we speak. The air which we exhale, which is connected to all air, an unbroken entity, like all the water in all the rivers in the world, leading to the sea, touching one another. John Lennon said, when you look into the sky, you think of it as far away, but if you follow it down with your eyes, you're standing in sky. You can regard this as adorable tosh and bunkum if your conditioning demands it, but so much of the truth is neglected. These truths are more important than the beliefs that I was taught to make me a compliant subject instead of an active citizen. West Ham's results, the Oscars, X Factor, even high cultural musings on Piketty or Roth or Bach or Beckett are not more important than the physical reality of our oneness. Anything that directs consciousness away from that truth instead of towards it is bollocks and it has to go. Don't worry, I panicked myself a bit there. I'm not suggesting a year zero book-burning immolation of all culture. I'd really miss West Ham. And to be honest, there's nothing wrong with X Factor in its place. Given that the profound can be quite well hidden in the spritz, tits and glitz of the all-encompassing, balmy mainstream culture, it is helpful to have stories, rituals and practices that attune us to less obvious but more important aspects of reality. Prayer, meditation and simple altruistic acts are behavioural portals to a neglected dimension. My personal daily programme includes all three. I pray, meditate and try to be kind, not generally, particularly. If I feel sad or agitated, I check myself and think, hang on, Russell, have you done anything for anyone but yourself today? Shockingly, the answer is sometimes no. Then I immediately hurl myself into enforced altruism, inflicting my aid on anyone in the vicinity. Sir, let me carry that.
It's my walking stick, I need it.
Hogwash, hand it over.
The super Jedi level of advanced altruism is when you do a kindly act and don't get found out, like no one is allowed to know about it. Now that is hard. God, I thought keeping my mantra secret was a challenge. Try doing something generous and kind and not telling anyone, even your boyfriend or your mum. It's like knowing George Michael was gay in 1986 or that Kennedy was murdered by secret services in 1963. You want to scream it from a grassy knoll outside the Club Tropicana. If you tell anyone, it doesn't count. God, it's tough. The other practical measure you can take is to make amends when you inevitably do something wrong. If you're rude or if you hurt someone's feelings, you have to apologise. I often get impatient. Impatience means I think, or my ego thinks, that it knows how the world should be running and wants to impose its will. My impatience can flare up in any situation. When I'm stuck in traffic, I can quickly sever my connection to serenity and become a senselessly fuming, impotent Hulk. The infuriating sense that my environment isn't behaving how it's supposed to is a kind of mental illness. The belief that my anger can influence the flow of cars up Shaftesbury Avenue is insanity. That is a very simple demonstration of how I voluntarily enter into a negative illusion. I become an impotent fury. The only people affected by my emotions are myself and the people with me, unless I allow it to contaminate the world further by winding down the window. To have the presence of mind to acknowledge that my only power in this situation is the power to make the situation worse. I checked into a hotel the other day. I had a belief that the process of administering a key should happen more quickly than it was actually happening. I began to become hot and fast and flustered. I started to impose my will on the people working at the hotel. As this is happening, there is a silent presence in me that knows my conduct is not cool, that I've moved out of alignment with my principles, that I've become defective. The presence also knows that it will be the one that has to come back downstairs to the hotel lobby later and apologise for being impolite and impatient. For now, though, this presence is tethered and very much a breathy backing vocal drowned out by the bombastic lead singer who is saying stuff that is hard to own. Just use a skeleton key to get me in the room and then do the admin later. I'll sign it when I next pass through. The backing vocal is in this moment just a passenger but knows this behaviour is arrogant, that this is not the man I've worked hard to become, that temporarily arrogant Russell has seized control of the steering wheel and is trying to do as much damage as he can before he's pulled over. Even whilst I'm administering haughty admonishments, the secondary, recently acquired, more awakened aspect of my being is preparing to apologise. Of course, the aim is to reach the point where I can fully contain the drama, where my defective conduct doesn't leak out into other people's lives. I reckon 80% of my madness is caught at the gateway to the outside world, which I suppose is my mouth. Before, when I drank and used drugs, I had no ability to refine my madness and it would bleed unfiltered across the blank day. The drink and drugs are in effect tools to anaesthetise the impetus to act destructively and the pain caused as a consequence. When drugs and alcohol and other compulsive behaviours are removed, you can address the problems that led to their use. When you have an understanding of those behaviours and some techniques to help you when you inevitably err, it is possible to develop a different conscious experience through prayer and meditation. Fairfield, Iowa, a community built around an ideal and a pair of tin boobs, provided me with sanctuary when I was writing Bookie Wook 2. We stayed in one of the serene cottages that satellite out from the orbs. Bob Roth gave us daily meditation lessons and took us around the educational institutes which are central to the community. There was a university and several schools catering to kids of all ages, and they seemed to me pretty typical, except twice daily the kids would break and meditate. I meditated with the kids and it was lovely. I was surprised, though, when I chatted to a group of them, that their ambitions for later life, which is one of the mandatory routes of inquiry open for an adult quizzing strange children, along with how's school and are you courting, were utterly in sync with those of any teenagers. They all wanted to be famous. The ambience of serenity and access to a realm of inner peace, a daily connection to the source of all phenomena, hadn't alleviated the yearning to strut about on stage in glittery leggings. Of course, these kids were smart enough to dress it up in fancy notions of art and humanitarianism. We can all do that. I'm going on Britain's Got Talent to end the horror of landmines. But it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that inner peace does not exempt you from the tractor beam of pop culture. Only one kid wanted to be a scientist, and I'm pretty sure he was Japanese. Thinking about it, Lakeside had a sort of dome bit at the centre, like a mammary gland conservatory, an augmented bust on an eroticised Statue of Liberty. Are humans really so geometrically rudimentary, like ducklings waddling along after our first nutritional kick? I'm certainly not condemning Fairfield. It has a lot going for it, and an aspiration to place spirituality at the core of the human experience more than all else is integral to our survival. Perhaps it's like communism in the traditionally understood sense. It must be absolute. It can't survive in an adversarial context, continually bombarded with oppositional consumer messaging. Those Fairfield kids with their stardust dreams are like pre-Glasnost Moscow teens craving blue jeans and Big Macs. One night, a couple of college girls came to the house while me and Nick were sleeping to flirt with us. We awoke to see them youthful and hopeful on the veranda. I was engaged at the time and had to turn them away due to a moral code. We watched them leave, dopely incensed by our angelic chastity, the way a dog watches distant sheep, doleful with swaddled instinct. We comprise the high ideals of the meditators and the earthly yearnings of the indigenous farm folk, for whom I noticed, from posters about the town, a travelling cage-fighting contest was a forthcoming attraction. Chapter 13. Spider-Man on Line 1. The oft-trotted-out Native American parable seems apposite here. It goes, each of us has two dogs in us, a black one and a white one. This is clearly metaphorical. Don't get caught up in the old lady who swallowed a fly anatomical improbability of the setup or the stock folktale assumption that black is negative and white positive, otherwise we'd be here all day and we'll never get to the point of the story. If I was an Iroquois tribal witch doctor and you started quizzing me on the visual grammar of my fable, I'd slip you a herb to make you impotent or just whack you with my tomahawk. The two dogs are vying for dominance, the tale continues. Which one wins, asks the necessarily cooperative recipient of the lesson. The one I feed, is the sage conclusion. There are two Fairfields, as surely as we have multiple potential selves. The dominant ideology will likely be the one that's the focus of the most energy. The subversion or coalescence with this corporal prior culture is the most obvious challenge we face in trying to bring about a truly different human experience. This is the nexus. Do you want to learn how to unify your individual field of consciousness with a unified realm of bliss and tranquility? Or do you want to lie spread-eagled and drooling on crystal while Taylor Swift tickles your brain into a saccharine coma? My only qualification for proselytizing is my ardent pursuit of the latter option and eventual acceptance of the former. I suppose we must each ask of ourselves, or each other, have fun with it. It could be a quiz. Two fundamental questions. One, are you happy with things the way they are? And two, do you believe that things could be better? I know most people want change. I know most people can't be happy with the current regime, not least because in any electoral process worth having, we might assume that the 3.5 billion people that have as much wealth collectively as the 85 people on the increasingly clammy, fast-moving, unsustainable fun bus would vote for a fairer system. Surely the remaining 3.5 billion earthlings minus the 85 fun bustards and their relatives are up for some amendments and all. I just used the calculator on my phone to subtract 85 from 3.5 billion, and the answer had a letter in it. It did. It had a letter E in it. Even the calculator has gone berserk at this injustice. That aside, I think a significant number of people are not happy with things the way they are. I'm not, and I've done all right out of this system. I've got a big house, a nice cat, and when I write books, they're immediately put on the school curriculum. So this system has not been bad to me. I've been given everything that I wanted. The problem is, I didn't really want it. That desire was put there. Who put it there?